Welcome to After the Buzzer, another edition from the Man Cave. Mike Gross alongside the owner of the Man Cave, Gordy Jones. Gordy, it's good to see you, my man.
Likewise. Yeah. I'm outstanding in yourself.
I'm good. And our guest, feeding the kids as we speak, he is Philadelphia Inquirer in columnist and noted author. We're going to talk about that and some sports writing related topics with Mike Sealski. Michael, welcome to the big show.
Michael, thank you for having me. Gordy, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
You got it. We want to start with sports writers' connection to their readers and the idea that the readers sort of can't process that we're not fans. I mean, I hope I'm... Okay. we noticed sort of a Twitter interaction that you had with some readers recently that kind of prompted this topic, which is something that I actually thought about a lot. It's really interesting to me. But anyway, why don't you kind of set it up for people who don't know what we're talking about, what this thing on Twitter, how it came about and what it was about.
Sure. So last week, after the Eagles had beaten the Vikings on Monday Night Football to go to 2-0, I noticed everywhere, whether you're talking about the media who cover the Eagles, whether you're talking about people on Twitter, whether you're talking about fans in general, people who aren't, in my mind, supposed to be fans, everybody was on the bandwagon with respect to the Eagles. Yep. And they're gonna go to the Super Bowl and look at Jalen Hurts and he's the best and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know if pushback would be the right word, but I felt like, you know what, in my job as a columnist, I'm supposed to make people stop and think a little bit.
Yep.
And one of the things I wanted to do was, and this is kind of the curse, as I said in the column, of being around Philadelphia sports for a long time and having a long memory. I remember a lot of times the Eagles were 2-0 and they didn't win the Super Bowl. Most years that they were 2-0, they didn't win the Super Bowl. So all years, actually, because they didn't even start 2-0 the year they did win it. So I wrote a column basically saying, look, everybody cool your jets. It's just two games. They look really good, but we don't know anything yet. And this led to the backlash that you guys are talking about on Twitter with respect to people saying, why would you write that? You're only writing it to be contrarian. Can't you let people enjoy, the Eagles winning a big game? And, don't you understand how fans think? To which my response was, of course I understand how fans think, but just because I understand how they think doesn't mean I'm supposed to write like one. I can understand them. I can empathize with them to a certain degree, but I can't be one. And this concept, I think, is foreign nowadays more and more because of the rise of the internet, the decline of newspapers, all sorts of different reasons.
They really, their connection to sports is purely emotional, so they have a hard time understanding that somebody could be as immersed in sports as we have to be without it being purely emotional. That's my Sigmund Freud assessment of the whole thing.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's how it feels to me. They really don't get that we're not fans.
Yeah, and I think you're 100% right, Mike. They are. It's emotional, and it's not really analytical. And I'll give you an example from the not too distant past that I think will make the point. So back in 2016, and this is the dark ages if you think about it now. The Eagles traded up twice to draft Carson Wentz in 2016. Mm-hmm. Their quarterback that year was supposed to be, up until they made the point that they made those two trades, Sam Bradford.
That's right.
So in the aftermath of those two trades, Sam Bradford requested a trade because Sam Bradford could read the writing on the wall that, hey, I'm not going to be their long-term answer at quarterback. There's no chance of it. They're going to take this kid. He's going to be their guy. Mm-hmm. And the aftermath of that was ridiculous to me in the sense that people in the media and, again, fans were accusing Bradford of being a wimp. Like, why doesn't he compete for his job? Because he knows the deck is stacked against him. That's why. Like, he can. Right. He's not an idiot. That's why he doesn't want to compete for his job in Philadelphia. And but people got swept away in the idea that, like, well, we have this new franchise quarterback coming in. Sam Bradford, of all people, should just get on board with it. And that's the way fans think, and I get it, but that doesn't mean I'm going to condescend to it, and that doesn't mean I'm not going to write a column, which I did, saying, hey, back off of Sam Bradford. Anybody who's torn his knee up two or three times and comes back to play doesn't deserve to be called a wimp.
Now, interestingly, though, in both of these instances that we've named, you're saying that the media has been guilty of the same overreaction and sort of fan, I guess, fan reaction that the fans have been, right?
Well, I think it's hard to use the term media anymore, Mike,
that's right.
In the sense that it's so diverse really and so point. Disparate that it's hard to say, well, the media, you know,
you're right.
It's fan sites, it's talk radio, it's Twitter, it's all of this kind of stuff. And look, we're all trying to like cling to survival. Okay. We all are in this media landscape. And for my part, I feel like the way that the Philadelphia Inquirer and me as a columnist can stand out and survive is by being honest and being a little bit detached and saying, hey, look, we understand everybody's getting swept away here. And sure, there are reasons why maybe the Eagles will be that good. But here is all this history and here's all this reality that says, wait a minute, hold on a second here. And, you know, are there people in the media who seem like homers when the Eagles are winning? Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of them
absolutely
out there.
True.
And I get why they do it, but that doesn't mean I have to do it.
The one that always gets me is like when the Eagles make the playoffs and you have people on Channel 6 with Eagles jerseys on during the newscast. That makes me crazy.
I didn't know that.
That makes me crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, and what people don't understand, Gordy, and you know, look, you guys know this from covering Penn State and the Eagles and these big institutions, that the coverage of them, when you are covering them on a day-to-day basis, it is not rah-rah, sis-boom-bah ever. I would take my colleague Jeff McClain from The Inquirer, who's been on the Eagles beat for more than a decade, and I would put him against any reporter in the city, in the state, in the country when it comes to knowing his beat and taking it seriously.
Right.
You know, when you see the people who are wearing jerseys or, you know, hey, we're going to have an Eagles giveaway, blah, 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 like, you know, you're not really doing journalism. You're just doing fan-ish stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not why I got in the business, and I'd like to think that's not why a lot of us still didn't get, you know, got into the business.
Yeah. So when do you think, was there a tipping point in all this in your career? I mean, as you mentioned, it has changed with all these different websites and with social media and with the decline of traditional media outlets. When was the tipping point?
I don't know that there was a single point, Gordy. I think One way to look at it is maybe the rise of Bill Simmons.
Yeah, that's
a
good one.
So influential.
Wow, that's good.
As somebody who was just unabashedly writing as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
A terrific writer, entertaining writer, but saying, here are my allegiances. I love the Red Sox. I love the Celtics. I love the Bruins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not hiding anything. And that legitimized a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it is just, I think, the slow, gradual transformation to where the content is what is getting people to subscribe or to click on the website. So what you end up having is the sports equivalent of Fox or MSNBC, where you are literally just kind of preaching to the choir. And any break from the narrative or the reality that that media channel sets up for its viewers and consumers is disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what's at play here. I think it's hard for people who read me, for instance, to understand that I come at these things in good faith, that I'm not writing, hey, cool your jets about the Eagles because I hate the Eagles or because I want to be contrarian or I just want clicks. I genuinely believe that. Like, cool your jets. Yeah, they look really good, but it's only two or three games. Calm down.
Yeah.
And it is really hard for even people who are thinking about it in pretty much good faith to understand that. It's not all lunatic fans that don't really get that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
To me.
And the other thing too, and I think you guys understand this as old newspaper guys like me, the one thing that really I feel like in years past changed the way that those of us who covered sports on a day-to-day basis thought about our jobs was deadline. You had to file that night by 10:30, 11:30. And if you didn't, you were SOL. And so what does that do? That forces you to not care about the result of the game and who wins and who loses as much as you care about finding a story or breaking a story or getting the news about the injury or the trade or whatever the case may be. And that leads to the natural detachment from the outcome of the game. You don't care as much whether Villanova beats North Carolina in the national championship game. You just need a column idea or story idea to materialize so that you can file by the gun. And once you're in that, in those conditions for a while, you stop caring whether Ryan Arcidiacono was crying at the end of the game or not. You just want to, you just hope your story holds up.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, how often are you now under the, I mean, I still am under the gun sometimes for a print. How often are you? What's your deadline situation?
I mean, it's been a while since I've covered a night game where I've written on deadline.
Oh, really?
The Inquirer has moved its deadlines up for print so early that often, if you're filing at the, like, I'm trying to think. I was at the Eagle season opener in Detroit, 1 o'clock start. I was there and Landover on Sunday, 1 o'clock start, not really under the gun there. So I'm thinking back to the Final Four, basically, when Villanova was in New Orleans and throughout the NCAA tournament. That was really the last time I was really writing on deadline in those conditions. Because otherwise, you file it when you have it and they put it on the web when they get it.
As a deadline is all the time and never now.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Exactly.
I remember years ago, speaking of that sort of situation, do you remember, I think it was 2005, the Eagles are playing the Cowboys, and Andy Reid is finally running the ball. So I'm writing this angle, and it's like going along swimmingly. I'm pretty much done. The game is unfolding before me. All of a sudden, McNabb not only throws the game-losing interception, he also like gets hurt on the play. So I'm just delete mode.
Oh, Gordy, that game is almost 17 years old.
Yeah.
And I use it as an example. Every single time I talk about deadline writing to a college class or a group of journalists, I remember it so vividly.
Same.
The Eagles were ahead 20-7 with about 4.5 minutes to go. And in that final 4.5 minutes, the Cowboys scored a touchdown to make it 20-14. McNabb threw the interception that Roy Williams returned for a touchdown. And on that play, he tore his groin as he had been dealing with a sports hernia, injured it further, was going to be out for the season. Then on the ensuing possession, Coy Detmer drove the Eagles into field goal range and David Akers missed the potential game-winning field
goal. I forgot that part.
So think about, I had an entire column written and I'm sure you did too. Eagles are back in the playoff race. Donovan McNabb gets revenge against Terrell Owens, blah, blah, blah. And all that went to pot. And I had 7 minutes to rewrite the entire thing.
It's a glamorous business.
It's the life of kings.
So I wanted to loop back about Bill Simmons because I listen to his podcast pretty regularly. And after the Ime Udoka news broke the other day, I listened to his podcast the next day. And it was just as if he was in mourning, you know? And to get back to the general theme that we've been talking about here, to me, that's kind of wrong. I mean, I get why he's that way, but it just seemed kind of wrong.
And this is just a minor detail, but he refers to those teams as we.
Yeah.
I hate that. That's not important, but he does.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not the way we came up in the business, and I understand that it's different now. And I guess there's an argument to be made that if you're wearing your allegiances on your sleeve, at least you're upfront about them, and therefore people can say, okay, well, at least we know – you know, where he's coming from, right? This is one of the complaints about when it comes to politics about media bias, right? This is something that, you know, and I politically speaking, I'll just be upfront and honest. I would say center right, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that conservatives, you know, really people way on the right complain about all the time that, you know, you say you're objective as a journalist, but when push comes to shove, you really, you know, you let your biases seep through and you give more favorable coverage to the people whose politics you agree with. And I suppose that's true to an extent, and that there's an argument to be made that if a Democratic operative is on CNN analyzing politics, that person's coming from a certain perspective, and it's good to know that. But you're supposed to strive for fairness. You're supposed to strive for, you know, acknowledging that there's more than one way to look at a situation and that, you know, you don't have all the answers, and you're not supposed to play for one team or the other. And that's even starker in sports, right? Like, Simmons makes no bones about the fact he hates the Sixers and hates Philadelphia. So, you know, whatever he's going to say comes through that prism. It's just like I look at it and say, well, it's not productive for me to listen to him talk about the Sixers or the Celtics because I know where he's going to come from.
Right. In fact, in his book of basketball, he was ranking the all-time great teams. He docked the 82-83 team because they didn't repeat. Well, neither did the 85-86 Celtics. So, I mean, it seems like a pretty stupid point to make. I mean, I get it if you're going to dock them, but that seems like a pretty stupid reason to do it. But that's my own, you know, little...
And yet I love that book. I thought that book was great.
Yeah, because he's an entertaining writer. Yeah.
He is, no question.
But stuff like that leads to me, and that's why... To me, journalistic standards are so important, is that because you judge everybody by the same set of criteria all the time, and if you're doing it right, and that's one of the things that infuriates me about politics nowadays, is that, you know, one side, you know, does something that seems untoward, and everybody on the other side yells, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, and then somebody on their side does it, and it's immediately good, and the other side is now saying, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. It's like, you know, it's... There's no intellectual integrity, it seems to me, anymore. Yeah. And, you know, the same thing can seep into sports. Like, we all know people who have their agendas, who want to protect people and, you know, have better relationships with certain teams than others. And, you know, you don't want that to color the way that you're reporting on things. And, you know, usually people aren't that media savvy about it. They just aren't. And it leads to, you know, bad outcomes, misinformation, all kinds of stuff.
And also, somebody gave Bill Simmons $200 million for his podcast empire. So,
yeah, life is good.
Yeah, there you go.
Mike, you make the same point. We had Laurie Schantz, who used to work for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, as well as the Miami Herald and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's now a journalism professor at the University of Oregon. We had her on last week, and she kind of made the same point you made about, yes, there is a certain degree of bias in everybody. You know, you choose... how you approach a topic, you choose what quotes you use, et cetera, et cetera. But you made the same point about fairness, that's the bottom line, not being objective. You know, I think
right.
that's...
Yeah, I think that's true. Look, you know, we all have our opinions about sports, politics, entertainment, culture, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if you are willing to kind of shut out any information, you know, that might deviate from the narrative or perspective that you prefer, then you're not really a journalist. You're just not.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're in your world, the Eagles are always awesome, or the Republicans are always right, no matter what they do, then, you know, what are we doing here? Yeah. You know, that's not what we're supposed to be doing.
And there's a lot of fans who I get a lot of interaction with. You know, I cover Penn State. I get a lot of interaction with them. There's a lot of fans who are as critical of Penn State as anybody could be. I mean, that's a common thing. It's not everybody thinking that the Eagles are awesome or that Penn State's are awesome, even among the fan base of those teams, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, Mike, the most devoted fan base of any team I've ever covered is the Philadelphia Flyers, okay? And for a number of reasons, you know, hockey is a niche sport. The team had a certain identity for a very long time, all of that. But you have to be able to look at that team objectively, and yet as close to objectively as you can, and with a little bit of a detachment to be able to say, what are they doing relative to the rest of the National Hockey League? What are they doing that's working? What are they doing that's not working? And if you can't do that, if you just presume that everything they're doing is great and they're trying to win the Stanley Cup every year and that's awesome and I want a team that's trying to win every year, and you're not going deeper to understand, like, why, even though they try to win the Stanley Cup every year, they don't, you know, and, you know, what's gone into their free fall since the salary cap came into effect in the league, then you're not doing your job. You're just giving people, you're telling people what they want to hear rather than what is actually happening or what they might need to know. Now, maybe they don't want it, and maybe we are just going to continue down this path of, like, survival means just parroting what you think people want to hear. But I'd like to think that people do want honesty out there.
Yeah, and I think they do. I get all over the place. I think people thought I hated Paterno. People thought I loved Paterno. It's all over the place, and that sort of makes you think.
That's fair.
Maybe you're doing something okay. Maybe you're going about it the right way. Yeah. I don't know.
I hope. You certainly don't get that kind of feedback generally on social media.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Twitter and you know things like that. And you know, I wonder how much we're conditioning. We've conditioned people over time to not expect that, or to just expect to be told what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you have had a lot of interesting interactions on Twitter with Flyers fans. I know. We talked about that. I think the last time you were on, just about how you engage them. Regularly.
You've had some interesting interactions with Flyers, Mike, yeah, right?
They are unaccustomed to encountering writers who cover the Flyers who, how can I put, like if you cover hockey, you're going to encounter athletes who are really accommodating to deal with, mm-hmm. and you are following a sport that not as many people follow mm-hmm. compared to pro football, college football, baseball, basketball. Mm-hmm. So, because of the nature of it, you're going to get people who really, really love it and mm. really, really love their team. And so they're not going to take well to a writer pointing out, like, look, you know, the coach is calling out his star players. And just because you love the star players and the mm. best, they're the best players on this team that you love, doesn't mean that the coach is wrong. And it doesn't mean that that's not what he's doing. And mm-hmm. if you don't like it, too bad. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Mike, let's go to the books. How was the Kobe Bryant, what I call the Kobe Bryant origin story? How was that kind of perceived? What kind of reception has the book received? I thought it was really a great idea. Well done. What are you hearing about? What have you heard? What has sort of the consensus been about the book?
I've been very fortunate, Mike, that the feedback on it has been terrific. I have not heard from the Bryant family in any regard. I haven't heard from Pam and Joe or mm-hmm. Kobe's sisters. But I actually spoke to somebody who was a close friend of Kobe's back when, you know, for a long time. I just saw him the other day and he told me, you know, you got it right. And
that's great.
Oh,
that's the
idea.
That's the goal. That's the goal always.
Yeah. And, you know, I think people. With a topic like Kobe Bryant, you're going to get people who say, naturally, like, is this book just hagiography? Is mm-hmm. it just Kobe's the greatest person in the history? People, and you're going to get people who don't want to read a book about Kobe Bryant because, you know, for, you know, the reasons that you guys can imagine, yeah. you know, the sexual assault allegations yep. and charges, they don't like him. Why are you godding up a accused rapist? All of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm content with how I handled that topic in particular mm-hmm. during the book. And, you know, I haven't heard from anyone who thought that I was unfair to Kobe or really that I was very inaccurate in anything. So that's been really reassuring.
How do you, I mean, I know that promotion is ongoing and I saw that you had what appeared to be a pretty intimate gathering with some other authors and some readers in Bucks County. It looked like a coffee shop or a bar or whatever this past week.
Gordy, it was a book and beer event. It was a pub crawl. It was the greatest idea in the history of ideas.
That is a good idea.
How do you regard the whole promotional thing? I'm sure it's immensely repetitive, but I've heard you on podcasts talking about it. It seems like you stay enthusiastic and on point and sharp about this. How do you regard this whole process of promoting a book?
It's a necessary evil. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know this, you're looking for, it's like trying to light a match and you're hoping that it sparks. Mm-hmm. And so you do every interview and you do your best to maintain enthusiastic about the latest interview you have to do. Mm-hmm. And you hope that somebody listens to it and, you know, it starts a fire that gets people buying the book all over the country. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you can do but that. And you hope that people have read the book that, you know, and are asking you questions that are informed by their having read the book. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it because there's no other person who's going to sell your book with the enthusiasm that you, the author, are going to sell it.
Right.
So you got to do it. And, you know, is it my favorite thing to do in the world? No, not necessarily, but it's a hell of a lot easier when you get a free beer at each stop.
There you go, That is a great idea.
Yeah. Now the next book, there's a next book, and the working title is Throw it down,
Big Man.
Which ought to tell most of the audience. They ought to be sharp enough to get the general idea. But in case they're not that sharp, tell us where you're going with this next one, Michael.
Sure. So the next book is going to be basically a history, boil down a history of the slam dunk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do kind of a narrative about basketball in American society through the prism of this one shot, the most powerful shot in basketball, the slam dunk. So, for instance, first dunk in an official game was at the 1936 Olympics by a roughneck named Joe Fortenberry, who was on the U.S. Olympic team.
Oh, that's outstanding. I love it.
There's the first dunk in a college game was in 1945 by a, you know, 7-footer from Oklahoma State. There's Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain taking the game above the rim. Mm. There's the NCAA banning the dunk from 1967 through 1977.
So incredible.
You know, to try to stop Lou Alcindor and other black players from taking over the sport. There's the ABA, which, you know, got the dunk mainstream. There's Dr. J and Michael Jordan and Ja Morant in the present day. And there's all kinds of stuff and places where this narrative can take you. So the book will be much more episodic than the Rise, the Kobe book was. Mm. But that's okay. I'm not trying to do like a definitive history of the dunk. I'm trying to write about interesting people and stories connected to this one shot, because I think it gives you a good perspective on how America and basketball have changed over time.
I can certainly see how when the very first dunks were done, I could see people saying, wait a minute, is that legal? Are you allowed to do that? I mean, did that happen? I would think it did. Yeah,
it was considered ungentlemanly at the time. how dare people do that and just stuff the ball in the hoop like that?
Ungentlemanly. Well, you'll enjoy this. So on Monday night, Julius Erving appeared out here at a banquet. Or no, it wasn't really a banquet. It was more just as a Q&A kind of thing. And they had a little reception beforehand. And some 5-year-old kid was coaxed to go up to him and say, rock the baby. And Julius kind of played along and he goes, rock the baby? Is that a dunk shot? It was such a...
I got Julius on the phone last week, 2 weeks ago, and I'll share this one anecdote because I know it's definitely going in the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked a lot about his career with the Nets and the ABA, because that was really when he was at his peak.
Sure.
You know, even after he joined the Sixers in 1976, his knees were starting to go, and, you know, as great as he was with the Sixers, he was even greater in the ABA, and so I said to him, you know, Doc, there's this narrative out here that the NBA was really, really struggling and, you know, nobody was interested in it. And then in 1979, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson came along and they kind of resurrected the whole thing. And he says, yeah, that's bullshit.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, thank you, Julius.
Thank you.
That's what we're looking for.
So I do hope that you include Maurice Cheeks' dunk at the end of the 83 finals, because that, to me, that was like the perfect exclamation
point. That was Gordy's favorite moment in human history.
It really is.
Not in basketball.
You know what? I loved your piece the other day, Gordy, about snail three. Exactly what the kind of thing I want to get into in this book is, that what does the dunk mean for, in a way, like, simply enough, masculinity in basketball. That's what we're getting down to here is, you know, the dunk. If you can't dunk, what does that mean for you in the sport?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That'd be a question to ask J.J. Redick or somebody like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mike, I'm intrigued by the Dr. J statement. I mean, in what sense was it bullshit? Did he go into any detail on that?
I think he was, and he did. I have to go back over my notes, Mike. But I think he was looking at it in terms of how great the league was in terms of its quality of play, even before Magic and Larry got there. You know, that they became a great storyline, and obviously those Lakers and Celtics teams were incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But Doc was the star of the league then, and the league still had, you know, Kareem and George Gervin and Elvin Hayes and a lot of great players. So I think Doc gets a little defensive about that because, you know, in particular, he feels like his ABA career is overlooked when he gets, you know, that he gets left out of the discussion of the all-time great, great players because nobody looks at his ABA career and counts it in addition to his NBA career.
Yeah, that's fair.
One of those things that you, how do you factor it in? That's true.
But you know,
well, look at it this way: when the ABA and the NBA merged, and the 24 players were picked for that subsequent season's NBA All-Star team, I think 10 or 11 out of the 24 had been in the ABA the year before.
Yeah, I knew it was a high number, and because I remember that even before the merger, there would be exhibition games where ABA teams would play NBA teams, and it was pretty even. It wasn't like, you know, the NBA dominated those games or anything like that. Yeah.
But, no, and there was a huge stylistic difference between those two teams too.
Sure, yeah.
Two leagues.
And somebody made the point, I forget who made this point the other day on a podcast I was listening to, that maybe the reason that Julius wasn't, you know, his numbers, like he averaged 29, I think, the last year of the ABA and like 21 the first year he's in the NBA. But the reason being, the ABA had the three-point line and it kind of spaced the court differently, whereas in the NBA it was all, let's tackle the guy when he tries to dunk kind of thing.
Yeah, you know? That's exactly right. The court was more cramped, let's put it that way, in the NBA than it was the ABA.
Yeah. So it's interesting that he would react that way, though, because, I mean, to your point, though, about Magic and Larry, I mean, the finals games were still on tape delay till, I think, 82. I think that was the last year that they weren't. So that was, you know,
weird to think about, but really I definitely remember it. I remember when they weren't on TV at all. I mean, that's how old I am. Some of those games in the finals.
That's pretty old, Mike. That's pretty old.
Just keep getting older.
So, Mike, just kind of break down a little bit what the timetable for this book. When's it coming, and what can you tell us in terms of what people can look forward to in terms of when they're going to see it and what it's going to be?
Sure. We're targeting it for 2024. I have to have the manuscript finished by November of next year. So I'm going to be working on it, you know, for the next year or so, doing the research and the writing. And, you know, hopefully we will target it, I would think, for the start of the, you know, 2024-25 NBA season. So I got my work cut out for me over the next several months as I track the Eagles on their guaranteed.
Oh, there it is.
And you know, we'll just we'll squeeze in book work when we can.
And yeah, try to get on the bandwagon already, Mike. I mean, what are you doing? What are you even doing?
I don't know, Gordy. I don't know what's good for me, I guess.
Okay. Michael, feed your kids, for God's sake.
Guys, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so
all right
much.
Likewise. Take
great
care. Be
talk
well.
You, man.
See ya.
All right.
So I always a good conversation with Mike Sielski. I think that might be the third time he's been on, Mike, maybe? And
I think that's right. I think it is the third time.
So so I guess he gets the cutlery, the after the buzzer cutlery for that.
The home version of after the buzzer.
No doubt.
I think that's what we're playing right now. We're playing the home version.
But yeah, it's a real, and I look forward to the book because honestly, and I didn't want to sound like I was, you know, blown smoke up his butt, but honestly, I think that his last book I thought was exceptional, and I think it's made him a sharper writer day to day in his column. At least that's my take on it. I don't know what you're.
Yeah, that we're doing banging out those columns and writing a book at the same time. That would be, well, I mean, for me, but of course I'm a mess. But that would be tough, and it would be interesting to see how they fed off of each other. There's so much difference for me,
right,
as a writer with a very limited experience of long projects. But there's so much difference for me for having a finish line at the end of the day,
sure,
every day, and getting it in the, you know, that deadline thing. I think is
oh God,
I'm so much better suited to that than I am to the long project where you're chipping away at it over a long period of time. And the two things to me are so different that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to overstate how different they are.
Yeah, I've really am when I'm writing longer stories, it took me a long time to wrap my mind around everything that you have. Yeah. And so I go to the point where I'll take an 8.5 and 11 sheet of paper, I'll fold it in half, and then I'll just like summarize like a transcript of, you know, quotes so that I don't miss anything. And then I'll have like this long transcript, and then I'll have like certain bio points about a guy on another sheet of paper.
Oh,
so
okay.
I try to organize it.
Oh, okay.
So it took me a while to settle on that, but that is the process that, and you know, it's up to others to decide whether that's working or not. But it's just like, I just found like for a long time, it just took me a while to really figure out how to just organize it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. That's right. When I did the Man I'm Central book, there was a point where I just couldn't figure out how I was going to get to the point where it's a now it's a narrative. Okay?
Right.
Now,
right.
And so my parents, I've told you about this, my in-laws cabin up there. I went out there and stayed there for 3 days.
Is that right?
And by myself. Wow. They were freaked out that I like slept there overnight and everything. But I did because I wanted to be away from internet and I wanted to be away from all that stuff. And once I got over that hump, then it was a narrative. And then it was a season that I'm telling the story of a season. Mm. But boy, it was tough to get
it
to
is.
That. There's, over that hurdle.
There's so much to just so much to really get yeah. straight in your mind. And
that's right. Get straight in your mind and then get straight on the paper.
So I heard a guy named Joe Goodman. He wrote a book about Alabama football fairly recently. And he said his process was he literally retreated to a cabin too. And he said he wrote 8,000 words a day for like a month, which just strikes me as just insane.
Yeah,
first
that's
of all,
insane.
I can't even picture right now. That's a lot of words every day.
8,000 words a day for a month. That's a book.
Yeah. And that's, and I've read the book. I mean, I was like, to be honest.
Slow down, fella. Come on.
It wasn't my favorite book, let me put it that way, but yeah. It was, I mean, I applaud the effort.
when my son was, this made me, just you saying 8,000 words made me think of this. When my son was maybe 10 or something like that, we went to one of those Transformers movies,
I think,
and it was just awful. And he knew it was awful. And I remember we were driving home, and he was, you know, he was bitching about it.
Right.
This sucked. And I said, you know, you should write a script for what the kind of movie you would make.
Right. That's
and
good.
He went home and wrote 8,000 words.
It wasn't
a script. It was like a stream of consciousness treatment sort of thing.
Well, that's impressive.
8,000 words.
How old was he?
I thought 10, but that must not be right. He was a little older than that, I think.
That's still damn impressive. That's a lot of words.
Yeah, that's a lot of words. And it's funny how sometimes you hit it and boom, it flows out of you. But that doesn't. You can't depend on that. You can't.
No,
you
no.
can't. You got to sit no. down and grind.
That's right.
Most of the process.
That's right. I mean, it's so satisfying when you do find that sweet spot, but it's hard to find.
Yeah.
It is hard to find.
Yeah, and you can't. Yeah, you just have to do it.
So we want to move on to other topics, and one of those is Penn State is now 4-0 heading into this week's game against Northwestern, and I mentioned this to you on Twitter the other day that after is it Catron? Is that how you pronounce it?
Catron. Yep.
Catron Allen. 13 for 111 with a touchdown last week against Central Michigan, whereas Nick Singleton, the star of the first 3 weeks, had 12 for 42. So do we now have a running back controversy, Michael?
Well, maybe because
they're both freshmen, first of all.
They're both true freshmen.
Yeah.
They're very good, and they're different.
Yeah.
Singleton reminds me of Herschel Walker.
Wow.
Very
fast
and very strong, and God hope he's smarter, but kind of in a straight line.
Right.
I really have not seen him break tackles or change directions or make people miss at all yet. And yet, he leads the country in yards per carry.
Yeah, so through, I have the stats here on screen. He's rushed for 42 for 376, a smooth 9.0 yards a carry.
Yeah.
Catron Allen has only six fewer carries, 36 for 217, 6.0. So both really productive, and of course that was really the question coming into the season: could Penn State run the ball? Well, they've answered that pretty well.
Yeah,
so far.
And they had a big breakthrough at Auburn in terms of offensive
Seems
line
so.
Play and winning the line of scrimmage against a good opponent. I thought, given that they got a little out of whack, as Joe would say,
out of whack, loosey goosey,
I tell some people about whack, but anyway. And this week, Northwestern has been bad, but they have a knack under Pat Fitzgerald of all of a sudden, inexplicably figuring things out.
Yeah.
I think this is a little bit of a dangerous spot. They're going into a bye week next week.
And then Michigan.
They think this is going to be easy. Mm. I think it's a little dangerous. I think it wouldn't surprise me if Fitzgerald cooks up something to cause some problems.
Yeah, I think that guy's been a pretty good coach for a pretty long time.
He has. And so far, it looks like two bad years in a row, and that's what it looks like so far, which has not been his pattern. Mm-hmm. He's had a lot of bad years, but they've bounced back. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Yeah. So it bears watching, though, but I think we see a lot of promise with that. We see a lot of promise with their defense, yeah. I would say. As their secondary in particular looks like a real strong point again.
Yeah.
So they're
very athletic. The freshmen have been better than you would have thought this mm-hmm. early, the right. first month of their careers. These dudes were playing high school football a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been better than I thought it was going to be, for sure.
So, are they going to be competitive with Ohio State and Michigan? Or because that's always the question.
I can't see them beating either of those two. And I think Minnesota is going to be a legitimate.
Because that's right. That's sandwiched between those
yeah,
two.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
play,
a pretty tough
They play team. Those teams. Is it 3 weeks in a row? I think it's 3 weeks. If not, it's three in 4 weeks.
Let me.
And Minnesota has been pretty good and a physical team. A physical team that's bigger.
Yeah, it's right
and, right yeah that's going to be a tough stretch. I think if they can win one out of those three, it would be okay. If they can get the 10 wins this year,
mm-hmm.
and in what I think a lot of people saw as kind of a let's get to the next chapter season, that would be pretty strong. If they can win on the line of scrimmage, then all this talent comes to the fore, and that's what's happened so far. But even if all this talent comes to the fore, they don't have as much as Michigan and Ohio mm-hmm. State, I don't think. The thing about Michigan right now is they lost a ton on defense. They're not,
right.
They don't have the players on defense that they did last year. But their offensive skill positions are really elite. You don't think of Michigan as having all these explosive dudes, but they do. And Ohio State, of course.
Yes.
If anything, even more so.
So, I mean, long term, I mean, can two freshman running backs or two obviously very talented guys, can they coexist? I mean, maybe you can play them together, but probably not.
It's a very good question. And you even get into the current environment with almost free agency in college football uh-huh. and you having to recruit the players after you've already mm-hmm. recruited the players. Is there any such thing as a transitional year? Is there any such thing as building for the future? I'm not so sure. Yeah,
I'm not so sure.
I mean, maybe you almost rethink where they are each year.
Yeah, I mean, forward. It's like I'm thinking about it at another position. I mean, they've obviously anointed Aller as their quarterback of the future. So, you know, that means Christian Velu and Bo Prabula, they're saying, well, where's the portal at?
Yep.
You know, which means, you know, conceivably, at some date down the road, if Aller gets hurt, you know, they're in the same situation with Taquan Roberson. You know, we don't have an adequate backup because that guy's gone.
Although they are bringing another kid in and for next year. But
it is a whole different dynamic, though. I hear your point.
Yeah, I think that's the deal. And honestly, I would be very surprised if Vayer or Prabula don't transfer at the end of this season.
Yeah, why would they stay? Why would they stay?
I would be very surprised if one of them, at least one of them, doesn't.
Because, you know, Velu at least proved a little bit last year that he can play, and Prabula was obviously a pretty, I mean, not as high level in a crew as Aller, but a pretty high level. So
now here's a this is just a goofy thing that occurred to me the other day that relates to this. You can play four games and still redshirt.
Mm-hmm.
They could redshirt Aller. They're not going to. There's 0% chance of that happening. Yeah. But they could redshirt him and give him four more years and sort of install Vayu as a very capable, very capable number two. But now that Clifford has played pretty well, I mean, that wouldn't be, there's no chance of it happening.
Yeah.
I'm not predicting it. It's not going to happen. But it wouldn't be the goofiest thing in the world, depending on how...
That's interesting.
How, what Aller thinks, what Aller's going on in his head.
That would be a really... I agree with you. I can't imagine that it would happen.
It's not going
to
happen.
I mean, it's like they've made a sizable commitment to actually getting him in games to this point, to keep him interested and, you know, to bring him along
Not as substantial enough as our boy Dave would like, though. He's asked Franklin about this every week.
Shocker!
It's actually pretty funny because Dave launches into these questions.
Soliloquies.
Yeah, he does. And
we're talking about our friend Dave Jones from Penn Live, who's been on this podcast repeatedly and is also I used to drive up with Mike and him to the games, and
right,
he is nothing if not passionate.
Yes. Yeah. God love him. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of so many moving parts, but I gotta tell you, Penn State is way ahead of where I expected them to be.
Yeah. So obviously this October is going to be a really, really interesting month for them, though. Really interesting.
Yep.
So we wanted to go on to some other topics too. One of those was Lancaster Barnstormers are in the championship series of the Atlantic League. They won game one. They will be back home on Friday. Mike will be covering that game. Now, this is my larger point about them. They've had a great season. They're bidding for their third Atlantic League championship in their history. But my point was about momentum, Mike. Game two of their first round series, down 7-3 in the ninth. They score 4 in the ninth, win it in the 10th, and they've gone on from there. They win the series, and now they're, you know, that much closer to a championship. So there are those who have studied such things who claim momentum or the hot hand does not exist. I think that's bullshit.
Well, I don't know if it's bullshit. It certainly feels that way for the thousands and thousands of games that you and I have seen. There has certainly seemed to be things like, and I even think sometimes officials get caught up in it.
Yeah,
sometimes
that is certainly true.
Yeah, and actually there's some research that indicates that seems to be the case, and that's part of the explanation for why over all major team sports, the home team wins 55-56% of the time, and some people believe that's part of the reason why. Certainly everybody who watches sports knows what is being referred to when you use the word momentum, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. The Barnstormers, and when you talk to Ross Peoples, the manager of the Barnstormers, I mean, it's all intangibles. We started believing in each other. We started playing for each other. We started developing confidence. I mean, that's the entire explanation for this surge. I think part of the explanation for this surge is the job that he's done of filling gaps when they lost guys.
Because that's a lot in that league. That's a lot of it. Finding guys.
Yeah, it's an independent minor league, and the guy who is the field manager is actually the manager of the baseball operation. Mm-hmm. He is what we think of as the GM of the Phillies, the player personnel guy. You know, he's that guy. The person who has the title of GM in the Atlantic League is a guy who runs the business, runs the concessions, and runs the promotions and all that. You know, he's a business. It's a small, not a small business, I guess, but whatever. But anyway, they always have problems in this league with losing guys who get signed. They get injured. When you get injured in the Atlantic League, you're not going in for an MRI tomorrow that the team's paying for. You're not going in for you know, like daily rehab with a team of trainers and doctors. Mm-hmm. They do have team doctors, and they have the Lancaster orthopedic people who help them out. But a lot of times when you have an injury and it's a substantial injury, you're going to be out for more than a week or so, you're kind of done for the year in the Atlantic League. And they had a guy, their best player the first month and a half of the season, a guy who was maybe the MVP of the league, he got hurt, and he hasn't been back. He hasn't been
who's
back.
That?
His name's Kelly Dugan. Huh. Big guy, power hitter. First baseman, plays a little outfield, they lost in about a 3 or 4 day stretch. They lost the three guys who were providing most of the power for them.
What was his injury?
I think it was a foot, something in the. I hope I'm not wrong about that.
So they literally don't do MRIs ever because of cost.
I don't know about that. I just meant that they're not having. It doesn't seem like they do the level of rehab
That's pretty interesting. But so what do you think about this team in general? I mean, it's obviously. I mean, back to your point for a second about. I remember when there was a CBA team in Lancaster, it was sort of the same situation. The rosters were very fluid, and it was like, you know, who do you know, or, you know, do you know a guy who knows a guy who can find, you know, a shooting guard Tuesday night when you're in Oshkosh or whatever, you know?
And then the other thing that happens in this league is they go to Mexico. They go to play the Mexican league to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes guys go to the Mexican league and then come back at the end of the year and mm-hmm. play, and are back on the team. And there's lots of things like that that go into it. But I think Ross has done a really good job this year of filling the gaps, and I think they have more pitchers than anybody else.
That's big because that league, it's hard to find pitching.
And he's a pitcher, and he almost is like a Whitey Herzog, you know, pitching, defense, speed, all that, which is kind of outmoded in some ways, especially in that ballpark.
Yeah,
that short porch to right field, you got to have guys that can hit it over the fence. You're not going to win if you don't. But it feels like they have more. It feels like they're trotting a pretty good pitcher out there every day, and these other teams aren't
mm-hmm.
quite with the depth in the pitcher.
Yeah, that's how I've gone to a couple of games, and not recently, but I know that it's like some of those games. It's just like, whoa, where's this guy?
And then you get into the bullpen.
It just gets ugly.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah,
it can get to be.
So we wanted to close on this, and that was the other day, as I mentioned in our conversation with Mike Sielski. Julius Erving was in Lancaster for an appearance, and one of the things that struck a chord with me when he came into, he did a Q&A with a representative of St. Joe's, and he was talking about role models and how Bill Russell had been his role model growing up. When he was at UMass, Bill Russell came and made an appearance on campus and actually took Julius out for coffee, and they spoke for 3 hours, and you know, he became obviously his idol, and understandably so. And he's wondering, you know, who can be this, you know, fatherly figure or this, you know, grandfatherly presence, whatever, for current players. And he actually said, the way he phrased it during this conversation, he goes, I think it should be me. And he said that, and there was applause in this ballroom where this conversation, but I thought about it, and as well-intentioned as I think he is, I just think the disconnect is too great. And also, I think there's a great difference between Bill Russell and Julius Erving. And I just don't think that's, he's going to quite resonate with players now as Bill Russell did with him and probably several others.
Yeah. And they were much
very close. They almost overlapped.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you're right about that. And I think very different people. Social and cultural critics, and that's not the right word, but I mean, there was an element of that with Russell that I just don't see with Dr. J. Maybe that's unfair to him, but he ought to be the guy who can influence that and kind of make that happen.
It was an interesting conversation he had. He said, you know, why is politics now elect and divide when it used to be elect and get behind, you know, whoever was.
I wonder how much it really was that way, and we just weren't hearing about
fair,
it as much because
fair.
You know, for obvious reasons, as far as
my larger point is that he, you know, I just think he's not quite in that realm, and that's no knock on him. It's just I just think it's a different. I think part of it is a different era.
But here's a thing that I would think about with this. Arnold Palmer, for example, is a guy who, I mean, certainly was not an important social critic, although he was a great guy and an historically important figure in the history of his sport. He was a guy who was tremendously influential. I think Jack Nicklaus was too, for future generations of golfers in terms of how you act, how you behave, how you conduct yourself like a pro, how you interact with people, how you meet your obligation to the public, all that stuff. And Dr. J could have been that for a generation of basketball players in terms of his dignity and just a gentleman and... But still cool.
Yeah,
still not cool. Not a stodgy.
No, not in the least. And he's still not. He's still pretty. He's still impressive. I'll give you an example. This really struck me as funny at the time. So I went into this ballroom. I was sitting at a back table, you know, just so I could take notes during this thing. And I'm sitting there, and the guy from St. Joe's is introducing Julius. He's going through his bio, and it's very kind and everything. I was like, all of a sudden, I feel these hands on my back. I thought it was somebody from L&P that I knew. It turned out it's Julius. He goes, boo. Really struck me as amusing. He was very happy. But there's a grace about him. There's an ease about him. He's really good at making everybody feel like they're the most important person in the room. Really good at that. I mean, there was a little...
And he does know you. You.
Well, I don't know. My wife and I were talking about that before, and does he remember you? And when I kind of sneaked into the VIP reception, I shouldn't say that in the air. Right. And I just and I was talking to him, and I didn't get any flicker of recognition. I mean, we weren't really doing an interview. I was just talking to him about, you know, this, that, and the other, about Pat Williams, a mutual acquaintance, about Harvey Catchings, who he played
with. But you have interviewed him.
Yeah, several times.
Over the years.
But there was no flicker of recognition. But the fact that he did that, my wife Barb goes, well, he must have remembered you then. He must have if he did that, right?
Yeah, that's how it seemed to me, too. But I don't know.
But at any rate, there's just a real ease about him. Just I'll tell you, he walked into this room. It's like there was a bar, there was a buffet there. And there was like this table with three people at it, and there's this fan. He just said, "Hey, we got an open seat here." So Julius came and sat down and ate his. He was really good, and you know, he took every picture, shook every hand. There's a real ease about him. But you know, to put him on Russell's level, I'm not ready to go there.
Yeah, different animal.
Yeah,
different
very much animal. So.
I hear you. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it was really fun. Oh, this is funny too. He walks in and he's like, he's greeting everybody, and then he walks over to the bar, he's getting some wine. And there's like two guys who work there in the Marriott downtown. And then the one guy looks at the other guy and goes, "What's his name again?" And the other guy goes, "Julius Irving."
Don't tell me that.
So there's that generational divide.
Grown. Yeah.
So I'm giving you teasers to the story. I'm not thinking these are little set pieces that they're in my mind.
That was a set piece.
That's
right
a
there,
good
my
set
friend.
Piece. Yeah. Yes.
All right. So look for that when and where.
It'll be on Liberty Ballers. I'm not sure when, but some point in the next couple of weeks. I have to sit down and again organize my thoughts and just. Go here and there, and
that's what we do. That's why we're here, to organize our thoughts and share them with you. All right, that's it. Another edition of After the Buzzer. Thanks to Mike Sielski,
yes,
Gordy Jones, Mike Gross. See ya.
See you later. And I just one last programming announcement before Pete Croato, who wrote a book about basketball, about NBA basketball and its rise on a business, will be with us next week. So we look forward to seeing you then.
Boom.
See you down the road.